Hello, and welcome to the Neutral Ground Podcast, where all of medicine meets. I'm your host, Sean Byers, a fourth-year medical student. Today, we will be talking about obstetrics and gynecology and maternal mortality with my fellow medical student, Eric Shuffle, as well as Dr. Veronica Gillespie. Dr. Gillespie is a board-certified physician in obstetrics and gynecology, has served in leadership positions both locally and nationally, and in addition to compassionate patient care, Dr. Gillespie is both very dedicated and passionate about education and is currently the clerkship director for obstetrics and gynecology for the Ochsner Clinical School. As always, the views expressed in this interview are not medical advice. Views and opinions of the guests and hosts do not necessarily represent those of the institutions for which they come from. And without further ado, please enjoy this interview.
Today's topic is addressing the rise in maternal mortality rate in Louisiana, a discussion of the Louisiana Maternal Mortality Review Report with Dr. Veronica Gillespie. Hello everyone, my name is Eric Shuffle. I'm a fourth year medical student at the University of Queensland Ochsner Clinical School, pursuing a career in obstetrics and gynecology. I'm very excited to have the opportunity to be a part of the Neutral Ground podcast for Ochsner Health System, talking with our OBGYN clerkship director, Dr. Veronica Gillespie, about maternal mortality. Dr. Gillespie is a board-certified obstetrician and gynecologist practicing at Ochsner Baptist Hospital in New Orleans. She earned her medical degree from Meharry Medical College in Nashville, Tennessee in 2004. She completed her residency training at Ochsner Health System here in New Orleans in 2008. Currently, Dr. Gillespie is an associate professor and the clerkship director for obstetrics and gynecology for the University of Queensland Ochsner Clinical School. Dr. Gillespie also serves as the medical director for Louisiana Perinatal Quality Collaborative and Pregnancy Associated Mortality Review. We are so lucky to have the very talented Dr. Gillespie take the time out of her schedule to chat with us about the impact and outcomes of the Louisiana Maternal Mortality Review Report published in August 2018. So without further delay, good afternoon, Dr. Gillespie. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
So before we get too far into the discussion of the report, I always find it interesting to ask physicians about what drew them towards medicine growing up, and specifically in your case, what about obstetrics and gynecology captured your interest?
Well, I was very fortunate to have a physician take an interest in me. During the Christmas break of my junior year of college, I was home visiting my OBGYN, and he said, "Oh, I hear you want to be a doctor." And I said, "Yes, I do." And he said, "Well, what kind of doctor do you want to be?" And I said, "Oh, I want to be a pediatrician because I love kids." And he said, "Yeah, you don't love them when they're crying and they're vomiting on you. You only want to be a pediatrician because you've never seen any other doctor." And so I thought about what he said, and he gave me the amazing opportunity to come back that evening and shadow him with doing a C-section. And for the 3 weeks that I was home for Christmas break, he allowed me to act as a third-year medical student. I scrubbed in on all of his surgeries. I was there for his deliveries. I triaged all his patients in clinic. And I realized at that point that OBGYN is what I wanted to do. It's such a great feel to be able to be there for a woman when she's delivering a baby and balance that with the amount of time in the operating room, and then to have relationships with patients really through their entire reproductive life and on into menopause. It's a great honor to serve in this capacity.
Cool. It seems like you got started early.
I did.
And how did you come to work for the Louisiana Department of Health, and specifically Louisiana PQC and the Pregnancy Associated Mortality Review?
Well, in addition to the other roles I have at Ochsner, I've been in charge of quality for women's services since March of 2015. And so I've worked on implementing different practices to ensure safer births here at Ochsner. And so when the Perinatal Quality Collaborative was developing, they were aware of the things that I had done here, and they asked me to be a part of the faculty as the collaborative was starting for the state. In this past July, the medical director decided to pursue another interest and asked if I would actually take her position. And I felt honored that she would think of me to do such a a large task, but such an impactful task. But I felt the work that I had done at Ochsner around quality, as well as a master's that I'm pursuing from Johns Hopkins in quality, combined with the 10 to 11 years of obstetric practice, I really felt it was a good move for me, and that I had the background and the tools to help make a difference. And it's a topic that's important to me as well.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So let's get a little bit back, talk about a little bit of the background about the mortality review that we're going to talk about. So published in 2018, the Louisiana Maternal Mortality Review, it's a mouthful, the Louisiana Department of Health reviewed death certificates to identify maternal deaths from 2011 to 2016 in women aged 10 to 55 who are both Louisiana residents and whose death occurred in Louisiana. The report defined maternal death as the death of a woman while pregnant or within 42 days of termination of pregnancy. Without kind of getting too far into the outcomes and results, can you talk a little bit about kind of what prompted the study's creation and kind of the subsequent reporting?
Sure. So we know in the United States, our maternal mortality rate is much higher than it is in other developed countries. And that's something that I think we have recognized, again, nationally, not just in our state. And so a lot of states have started to try to investigate and figure out why is this happening. And from this, the CDC has actually put in support and funding for several states to start doing maternal mortality reviews. And we are fortunate to be one of those states. And so that was the initial impetus for starting this process. During that time period of when the reviews were done, the process was not as scripted as it is today, now that we've done it for a while and have a better idea, and the CDC has a better idea of how maternal mortality reviews should be done. But that was the initial starting, just trying to figure out, okay, there's a rise in maternal mortality, what is going on? Mm-hmm. And the only way to know that is to look at the data.
Sure. So I guess talking about the data, kind of what did what were the reported findings? What did the report kind mm-hmm. of show?
So from 2011 to 2016, there were 47 confirmed deaths. I think some of the highlights of the report, they found that hypertension and hemorrhage were the two most common preventable causes of maternal mortality. And, you know, I think something that is very kind of inspiring that we can make a difference, but also very sad, 45% of those deaths were deemed to be preventable, mm-hmm. Which, again, we take that information now to make changes as a state and as different healthcare systems, because we know that we could be better. Also, something that was astounding is that when they looked at the at the rates, four Black women die at a rate of every one white woman. So we have a huge disparity. And so finding all of these things have kind of helped shape what we are doing on the perinatal quality collaborative side to make sure we are equipping our hospitals to better recognize and take care of women with hemorrhage and hypertension, but also making sure that we are doing it in an equitable way.
Mm-hmm. So I know you talked about, one of the things that we saw was that there was a rise in maternal mortality. I know the report says a few of them, but what are kind of in your words, mm-hmm. kind of the reasons or the proposed idea why this rise has occurred? I mean, do we know, or is there some proposed ideas?
Well, some of it is a data issue.
Sure.
Of course, as you start to look more and you are perfecting the ways that you're determining deaths and all of those things, then the numbers are going to be higher. So that's one part of it. I can tell you that because we are about to publish another report, because it'll only be a year's worth of data, but it's going to look like we're doing worse. We learned from doing the maternal mortality review from 2011 to 2016 that we actually probably did not capture all deaths. So on our death certificates, and when you think about how we were capturing deaths, it was mostly through vital records. And in the past, our vital records did not have a box that indicated if the woman had been mm-hmm. pregnant. Mm-hmm. We have since changed that on our death certificate. So there is a box that, as it's being filled out by the coroner, they have to indicate whether or not the woman was pregnant. So that's going to allow us to pick up even more deaths. So some of it is from that standpoint. It's not that we're necessarily doing worse. It's that we are capturing the data in a better way.
Sure. Now, does that kind of capturing the data a different way? You know, we see the trend also rising across the United States. Are there any thoughts to you? Is it a similar way where we're capturing more data across the United States as well, and that's why we're seeing it?
Yeah, I do. I do think that that's what it is. I think we're. I think it's a combination of things. We are capturing the data in a different way, but we also are having different risk factors that we didn't see before. Mm-hmm. From our report, we did find that a larger number of the women that died were over 35. Mm-hmm. So we are in a time where we are having pregnancies at a later age, and that is a risk factor for death as well. So there's some other factors other than just the data about our patient population, how we deliver care, things like that, that are also contributing.
Okay. And the report also gave recommendations, kind of things that we can do moving forward mm-hmm. to address the rise in maternal mortality. Can you talk a little bit about what your role kind of was in kind of implementing those recommendations, or kind of what those, over the highlights of what the report said about what those recommendations were?
Sure. So my role, I'll answer that question first. So my role, as far as the recommendations are concerned, as the medical director of the Perinatal Quality Collaborative, is to help develop initiatives and determine what those initiatives should be. And we determine those initiatives based on the data from the PAMR report, is what we call it, PAMR for short. My role is to help, again, develop and guide those initiatives, and then help help with implementation in hospitals. Right now, through the Perinatal Quality Collaborative, we have 39 of our birthing facilities signed on. And we've worked on, since August of 2018, hemorrhage and hypertension. Because again, from the report, we know that those were the two most common mm-hmm. preventable causes of maternal mortality. So we've really focused on those, as well as, again, trying to decrease that black-white disparity gap, worked on things like implicit bias training with our mm-hmm. facilities, helping them to be more comfortable with race and ethnicity, helping them to stratify their data so they can make sure that they are confirming that they're providing equitable care. And so those were some of the recommendations. Some of the other recommendations are making sure that women are allowed insurance coverage mm-hmm. beyond the time of just the 6-week postpartum period, making sure that obstetricians and emergency room providers are collaborating, because we did find that about 20% of the deaths occurred in emergency rooms mm-hmm. or around emergency rooms. So making sure that we have that there, making sure that facilities are constantly doing quality improvements so that they know where their gaps in care are as a system, so that they can improve those gaps as well.
Mm-hmm. And do you think, kind of from reading the report, like you said earlier, some of those kind of preventable deaths, meaning like the cardiovascular disease, the hypertension, the hemorrhage, kind of in your opinion, kind of what do you think are those barriers in preventing those deaths kind of in future? Like you mentioned a few of them, mm-hmm. but like, you know, what do you foresee kind of how you will approach kind of breaking those barriers down?
Yeah, so definitely with both of those disorders, early recognition is key. Mm-hmm. And so one of the things that we've done around hemorrhage, and not just that we completely just made this up out of the blue, there are patient safety bundles from AIM, the Alliance for Innovation in Maternal Care, that advise and give recommendations for how we should be placing patient safety bundles to address some of the things that we're addressing, hypertension and hemorrhage, and there are others. And again, one of those is the early recognition. So doing risk assessment on women when they're coming into labor and delivery to determine what is their risk for hemorrhage. And if they have a high risk for hemorrhage, making sure that you have those resources available. Doing it, again, when they're being admitted to labor and delivery, as well as intrapartum, because the risk can change in the middle of labor. And then also then conveying that when they're going over to the postpartum floor. The other big part of that we stress is quantifying blood loss. The days should be gone of reacting to a woman's blood loss, so waiting until now she's showing signs and symptoms of of anemia because she's had or acute blood loss anemia, and then trying to catch up. Because you have to remember, for the most part, most of our patients are healthy women, so by the time they're showing those signs and symptoms of acute blood loss anemia, you're already behind the eight ball. So if you're measuring blood loss as it's happening, you can have a better idea of when you need to go in and start doing blood products and replacing blood, as well as, again, being prepared based on that risk assessment. So having uterotonic agents right there available, not having to go, you know, to a whole nother unit to go get your medications to respond to ADNI, you know, things of that nature. And then, again, with hypertension, it's early recognition, making sure that when women present with signs and symptoms consistent with preeclampsia or hypertensive disorder in pregnancy, that we're triaging them within 15 minutes of presenting, that they're having those blood pressures taken within 30 minutes, and that physicians are treating elevated blood pressures within 60 minutes of presentation. So again, just trying to be more proactive and not reactive in taking care of our patients.
So kind of, I guess, beyond, we've talked about maternal mortality a lot and kind of identifying, you know, risk assessments early, identifying things before they become problems later on. Kind of beyond maternal mortality, what else kind of was hoped to be achieved from implementing the recommendations of the report?
So I can say now, especially now that I've gotten into this role, most of our efforts have really focused on facilities, which is a big portion of maternal morbidity and mortality. But I am of the mindset that we need to focus on the entire system of care. And so just as I was presenting to the secretary's executive staff last Monday, that the maternal mortality report is just the tip of the iceberg. So at the tip of the iceberg, you have mortality, but all beneath the water is all this morbidity. And so the morbidity is what we need to address. So again, yes, we have addressed it in our facilities, but we need to do more in connecting with our community. Trust has been broken. Now that the there's been more of a light as to what our stats are here in Louisiana, and it's been made very public, which is good for engagement, but at the same time, it has scared our patients. I have several patients who, during their prenatal visits, have asked me, like, legitimately, am I going to die when I deliver my baby? I'm a black woman, and it says that four black women die at a rate of every one white woman. Is there something else I need to do? So our patients are scared to do what is a very natural process, giving birth. And so we've got to rebuild that trust. We've got to equip our mothers so that they know what signs and symptoms to look for, what questions to ask when they go to the doctor. But we've also got to equip our doctors to be able to answer those questions and create a conversation that builds trust with the patients and with facilities as well. So that's one part of it. The other part, again, is looking from a more of a systems approach outside the hospital. Do our patients have access to what they need to be able to get to the doctor? And now we're talking about looking at things like social determinants of health. Do they have transportation? If they don't have transportation, can we look at a different way of delivering medicine? My answer to that is yes. And so I am pushing very hard for us to develop a better telemedicine system as a state to deliver care to patients, especially high-risk care during the prenatal period. And we know that this is a successful model. This is what's done in Arkansas through the Angels program. They have some of the similar challenges that we have being a very rural state where the patients can't always get to the resources, so they bring the resources to the patient. And so I think, again, that we need to look at how we deliver care and the whole system and not just the facility. When a woman enters in pregnancy or she's coming to the hospital to deliver, that's a very small time period in her entire care that affects her outcome. And so we've got to look at the whole woman.
Sure. I guess in your opinion, what is a realistic goal, maybe 5 years, 10 years, 20 years down the line, not just for the state of Louisiana, but maybe the United States as a whole? Obviously, mm-hmm. we see the trends, and you mentioned, obviously, data collection. There can be maybe an abnormal spike in the rate, but, you know, with it still identifying more maternal deaths than maybe we've ever seen before, what is a realistic goal moving forward for Louisiana and the United States?
So, I mean, I don't know if it's realistic or it's just my dream, but I would think that, I mean, we should be able to get to, you know, less than 5%. There are some deaths that are unavoidable. I mean, there are some things that we are not going to be able to change and prepare for, things like amniotic fluid embolism. Those are things that we can't change. As we review the deaths, not everything is related to something medical. Some of the deaths are due to suicide. Some mm-hmm. of the deaths are due to domestic violence, intimate partner violence, violence in other ways. So I think, to be realistic, I think less than 5% is reasonable. And I think it's achievable. I mean, they've gotten to 0% in England by putting different processes and systems in place. Now, we're not England, so I don't know that we're going to sure. get to where they are, because we deal with some different factors that they don't deal with. But I do think that less than 5% is achievable, and it's where we should be shooting for.
You mentioned England, and since, you know, this medical school is kind of coordinated with Australia and also being a different medical system, do you see either in England or elsewhere something that you'd be like, you know, maybe we couldn't now implement that type of system or part of a system to help with the maternal mortality rate, mm-hmm. but is there something that you've seen abroad where, like, you know, that they've done a great job there? Mm-hmm. At this specific example, is there anything that kind of pops into your head?
There is, and which goes to another idea that I have. So definitely in Australia and in England, they definitely use their midwives, but they employ mm-hmm. midwives much more than we do in the United States. You know, we definitely have a shortage of providers. So we do not have enough providers to take care of all of the women that are in Louisiana. I mean, that's true across the United States. We've known for about 10 years now that at this point we were going to have a physician shortage in the United States. So that's not new knowledge or unexpected outcomes. But we do have midwives that are completely capable of providing care to low-risk women. And so I think a thought or an idea is us being able to assess or risk assess women as they enter the pregnancy to see if they are low risk or if they're high risk, and if they're low risk, to be able to offer them care through other means, that not necessarily seeing a physician, but maybe seeing a midwife, nurse practitioner, allied healthcare provider, so that we can better divvy up divvy up our resources.
Sure.
And definitely in being in Australia, the four times that I've been there and spending time in the maternity ward, their midwives are the primary providers of mm-hmm. care, with the obstetricians and the maternal fetal medicine specialists being there to provide the high risk care for those patients that need that. And I think it's a model that works. In Louisiana, we do have two midwifery schools that are in the process of starting and getting their accreditation. And so I think that will be great for the workforce. You know, this model has been done in Florida as well, where they've created kind of medical homes that are midwifery run. And they are safety net clinics, and they provide great care, and it has helped their outcomes. And so there was a thought to do something like that here, but we just don't have the influx of work. We don't have the workflow. We don't have the influx of midwife providers.
Sure.
So hopefully having these two schools will help with that, and we'll see better outcomes from that as well.
Okay. I have a little, maybe even a mundane question, talking about definitions, and I think definitions in especially in research and these type of reports is good, because you can change what the data looks like based on what definitions you're using.
Mm-hmm.
And here in the report, some of those definitions really matter, because you know, the CDC and even the World Health Organization, how they describe either maternal death or pregnancy-associated or pregnancy-related deaths. I think those are a bit different, but they also change how you can identify and report your statistics. Can you maybe kind of elaborate a little bit upon maybe the differences of the three and then why we used maternal death here as opposed to pregnancy-associated versus pregnancy-related death?
Sure. So for just the definition, first of all, of maternal mortality, because it is different, like you said, depending on what resource you're looking at. So the World Health Organization says a death is within 42 days of pregnancy, whereas some other sources, I believe the CDC does it this way, is a year. So that will change your numbers if you're looking at different time periods. And I don't know the reason for why they have different definitions, but they do exist. And we have pregnancy associated versus pregnancy related, and our new report will break out our deaths in those two definitions. Okay. So a pregnancy associated death is a death that's due from something associated with the pregnancy. Mm-hmm. For example, if I have a patient that has a hypertensive disorder of pregnancy, blood pressures get too high, and she has a stroke and she dies, that's pregnancy associated. Pregnancy related means they just happened to be pregnant at the time and the pregnancy did not increase the risk of dying. So for example, if I am pregnant or not pregnant to make it even, bring it home a little bit more. But let's say that I delivered 2 weeks ago and I'm driving and I die in a motor vehicle accident. Yeah. Okay, so that is definitely within the 42 days or 1 year, doesn't matter which one you're using, but nothing about the pregnancy had anything to do with me dying. Sure. So that would be, you know, more pregnancy related.
So I'm just kind of wrap it up a little bit, but one of my last questions is going to be more broad. It's like, given your experience in the field, what would your advice or message be to either medical students or any training physician or residents on how to kind of best provide quality obstetric care?
So that's a loaded question, but I will answer it anyway. Now that from this experience that I've had working with the Perinatal Quality Collaborative and with the Pregnancy Associated Mortality Review, and also pursuing a master's in patient safety and healthcare quality from Johns Hopkins, I feel that every medical student, every resident and every practicing physician should have some course in public health, quite honestly, just to even go through the basics of public health. It makes you look at things in a different way. It makes you think about things from a systems approach. It makes you understand how what you are telling a patient doesn't always translate into the expected outcome. For example, if I prescribe a medication, I expect the patient to take it. But if you don't think about the other factors around that, then you really haven't helped that patient. So I think just knowledge and understanding of public health and its impact on health is paramount. And so I would advise everybody, I'm not saying you have to go get a master's in it, but if you could take some public health courses, I think that that's huge. The other part I would say about that in doing this work is everybody should do implicit bias training. If anybody is not familiar with what implicit bias is, and I quite honestly did not know what this even meant, 5 years ago, and maybe nobody did. But implicit bias is your unconscious thought that you have towards an individual based on your exposure or upbringing or past. But there's a lot of data that shows as a provider, whatever your implicit bias is, that affects how you treat your patients and it affects patient outcomes. And so it's really important for us to be aware of our biases because we all have them. Nobody is neutral on everything. So we all have a bias. But it's important to know and understand your bias so that you can check yourself at the door when you're interacting with a patient that you have a bias against. And I really think that's the only way we can make sure we're providing equitable care. Mm-hmm. And so everybody should take the Harvard Implicit Bias Test and do some training to figure out ways to overcome your biases.
Great. Well, I've exhausted all the questions I have for you, Dr. Lesby.
Yes.
Unless there's something you want to add.
No, that's all. That was great. Those are great questions to get the topic out.
Thank you for taking the time to discuss this important subject.
Yes. You're very welcome. Thank you for having me.